You know, it's important that as we learn about the Word and as we learn about what God is doing in the life of Israel and how He's ministering to them, He continually teaches us on how we in our Christian walk are to act and are to react to those things that happen. We started out in Ezra and we saw that Cyrus, the king of Persia, gave the Israelites permission to go home. And not only did he give them permission to go home, but he also gave them some funding from the people around them, some provisions, and a letter authorizing them to rebuild the temple. And so it's been about 2 years since they set out from chapter 1 until we get to chapter 4 of Ezra. And they've been there, they've kind of gotten into their cities, they've done a few things. And now I want you to imagine, 2 years is not a very long time when you have to rebuild all of the cities, you have to rebuild the temple, you have to get commerce reestablished, lines of communication going again. This is really what some of our apocalyptic movies of today kind of look like when we talk about how they rebuild and they reconnect and they kind of reestablish civilization. That's what they were doing. They're out in the middle of nowhere now with not a lot of people around to help them and they're doing everything by hand, by themselves. And so during this time, they had started to set up their cities. They had already laid the foundation of the temple. And now that there's some tangible signs of progress, there are landmarks, like the foundation of the temple has been relaid. The people of the surrounding areas start to take notice. Maybe this isn't just a vain endeavor. Maybe they are going to try to rebuild the temple. Maybe they are going to try to do what's right. And so now that there are starting to be signs of light, if you would, in Jerusalem, the surrounding areas, specifically the Samaritans, they come and they're going to offer their assistance to the Jews. Hey, we'd like to help you. But in the end, what we're going to see is a confrontation that continued on. Well, it continues on even till today. And it stops the rebuilding of the temple for over a decade. For 16 years, they put on hold the rebuilding of the temple because of this opposition that they're going to be facing. And as we look this morning at the Jews and how they were dealing with this, we're going to be looking at how we are to face opposition. What do you do as a Christian when people oppose you in your faith? When people oppose what you're doing? You know, one of the most important things that we can remember is that Satan will not sit idly by and watch his control over you, his control over this city, his control over this nation, just be eroded by the gospel. He will not just sit idly by. And one of the things that we have to understand is that wherever the work of the ministry is performed, there is going to be opposition. There are going to be trials. And where there's ministry, there will be attacks. I heard it said this way once, where there's light, there's bugs. And that's the way it is. Where there's light, there's bugs. And as you start to shine in your life, as you start to give evidence in your life of a change and of the Lord's work and the Lord's move, the enemy is going to attack. Now, it's interesting. Before we get into Ezra chapter 4, Paul said something in 2 Corinthians that I'd like to read to you. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 3 through 6, Paul said, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but they are mighty in God for pulling down of strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." Now, I love what he says there because, you know, a lot of times in my life, I consider trials to be the hard things, the bad things. I consider trials to be people who hate my guts, people who don't like me. I consider trials to be a lack of finances. I've always considered in my life trials to be arguing with people. How many of you have had that same perspective on trials? It's the bad things that happen in life, right? But here we're going to get a glimpse this morning that the enemy, he's a little cunning. And he doesn't just use hardships and what would be outwardly negative. You know what's funny? The Bible talks about Satan as he appears to be an angel of light sometimes to people. If you saw a horned beast with a tail and a pitchfork, would you marry that person? No. Would you be friends with that person? Probably not. They don't ever look that way on the outside, do they? No, they come clothed in sheep's clothing, but inside they're ravenous wolves. And one of the things that, as we look at our warfare, we say, well, yes, we know it's spiritually based and it's not just physical, but do we as Christians understand that opposition is not only physical as well, but that the opposition can be conniving and sneaky, and that they won't only use just a lack of finances, and they won't only use a problem between you and your spouse, and they won't only use a death in the family, but they can use what would seemingly be good and right to lead you astray. The Bible says something important. It says, every man does what is right in his own eyes. You see, the enemy uses what we think is good and right, what we justify in our minds, to sidetrack us. And so this morning, we're going to be looking at three of the devil's favorite tools, I believe, in his attacks on our lives, three of his favorite weapons. And in this fourth chapter, we're going to look at how we can defend ourselves from those weapons. So start out with me in verse 1. It says, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the descendants of the captivity were building the temple of the Lord God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel, who was the head, the leader, and to the heads of the fathers' houses. And he said to them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. And we have a sacrifice to him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the heads of the fathers' houses of Israel said to them, you may do nothing with us to build a house for our God. But we alone will build to the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, has commanded us. Now, I like that the author here, Ezra, starts out in verse 1 and he says, and when the adversaries of Judah, he starts out by calling them adversaries. Now, up until this point, there's been no recorded instance of animosity or issues between Israel and Samaria. Up until this point in history, there have been no battles, there have been no arguments, everybody's been kind of amicable in their terms. But now, we see that Samaria says, hey, you're building God's temple, we want to help. Have you ever been really frustrated at a daunting task that was very difficult, and finally somebody comes up and says, hey, I want to help? It's a relief, isn't it? To finally have someone there who seemingly cares about the task that you have been charged with, that wants to help you, that wants to get you where you're going. Now, the Samaritans say something when they talk to Zerubbabel. They come to Zerubbabel and they say, hey, you're building God's temple. That's awesome. We're going to help you because we seek your God. They didn't use the word God there. They didn't use Yahweh or Elohim. They just used the pagan word for God here. We seek your God as you do. And there they have half of the truth. You see, a lie isn't palatable. You can't believe a lie unless it's based on something truthful. And so, they say, we seek your God. That's the first half of their statement, and that's true. They worshiped God. They gave him gifts and sacrifices. The Samaritans even had their own temple. But what they didn't do was they didn't do it as the Jews did. You see, here's what happened. Northern Israel had separated from the Jewish people. They had separated themselves from Judea and Benjamin in the south. And so we have southern Israel, which had the temple and it had the service of the Lord and it had the sacrifices and the altar and everything else. And when northern Israel separated themselves from southern Israel, they also separated themselves from the worship of God. And so what did they do? they kind of set up their own little altar and their own little system up in northern Israel so that they could still worship God without the son of Solomon getting in their way. So now they have their own system, and a number of hundreds of years later, the Assyrians came in, and in 722 BC, the Assyrians come in and they decimate northern Israel. And if you remember, they came against southern Israel, and they camped against Jerusalem. And that was when the Lord and the angel of the Lord killed 185,000 of their men in one night. And they took off and they ran away. So they conquered northern Israel. They couldn't conquer southern Israel, and they went home. But when they conquered northern Israel, they did what the Babylonians did. And that was that they took all of the people out of Israel, of northern Israel, and they sent them somewhere else. Some to Babylon, some to other places. And they took people from other places like Babylon and others, and they brought them to Israel. That there would be no one who owned the land in the land. The idea was is that they wanted to get people from trying to revenge their fathers and take back what was theirs. If you take somebody out of their land, if somebody were to take you out of the United States today and transplant you to southern China, you wouldn't be able to retake the land that was stolen from you. You wouldn't be able to rise up against your oppressor because you'd be out of the land. And so it was a military tactic that many countries used. The Babylonians used it. The Assyrians used it. The Persians, they were the first ones to kind of reverse that whole line with Cyrus. And the only reason he did it was because God told him to. But what we see here is that when they took out the Israelites from northern Israel, you know what happened? Well, the word tells us in 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 24 through 26. I'm going to read that for a second. Listen to 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 24 through 26. Then the king of Assyria, he brought people from Babylon, from Cutha, from Ava, from Hamath, and from Sepharvaim, and he placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. And they took possession of Samaria, and they dwelt in its cities. And it was so at the beginning of their dwelling there that they did not fear the Lord. So what happened? They brought in all these pagan peoples to the land of Israel, where God said this is Israel's land forever. And what did they do? They started worshiping these false gods. And that upset God. And so he says, therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which killed some of them. So they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria, well, they do not know the rituals of God, of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and indeed they are killing them because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land. So God got frustrated and mad at these pagans for not serving him, the one who owned the land, and so he sent lions. And the people got freaked out. So they send the king of Assyria, and you know what they asked? They said, send back some of the captives so that they can teach us how to worship this God of this land so he'll stop sending lions. Now, rather than just dedicating their service to the Lord, realizing that he's got lions, and your wooden images and your graven idols, well, they can't do anything, but this God has lions. You might want to do what he says. Rather than dedicating their worship to the one living true God, what do? They did something that happened in the early 4th or 5th century of the Christian church. It's what we call the paganization of the faith. Constantine declared the Christian faith to be the only faith. But you know what they did? This temple that yesterday was to serve Diana became the temple of Mary. And this temple that was for Zeus became the temple of Peter. And this temple that was for this other god became where they worshiped this other god. And what did they do? All of the pagan rituals that they used for those other gods, they just rolled them in and called them, oh, this will be for Peter, St. Peter and Mary, and this will be for Jesus, and this will be for... They didn't turn their hearts to the Lord. They just changed the names of their idols. Have you ever wondered what's the deal in some of those ultra-Orthodox faiths? What's the deal with, like, the smoke and the ritualistic mannerisms that they have on everything? You ever wonder where that came from? Well, that's where it came from. So what the Samaritans did is they did much of the same thing. They took the name of God, but they took all of their rituals and all of their junk that they used to serve their pagan gods, And they just change the names. So when they come in and tell Zerubbabel, hey, this is awesome. We've been serving God for years. He's like, no way. You have no idea what you're doing. You have been serving the gods of Molech and Asheroth and Baal. But you have not been serving Jehovah God, because God does not want human sacrifice. God does not want sexual immorality and orgies at his temple. God does not want fornication. God does not want all this junk that you say you're doing in his name. Do not begin to say that you have anything to do with our God. You see, the land of the nation of Israel was called to do one thing: declare to the world that there is one God and his name is Jehovah. That's it. That was their job in life. That was it. You ever thought it'd be nice just to have one job in life? One simple task. Wouldn't it be easy? That's all they had. To let the nations know there's not multiple gods. It's just the Lord, and his name is Yahweh. Serve him alone. That's it. But when these other nations came in and started corrupting that, what did they do? They corrupted Israel. You know, they asked, not because they wanted to help Israel, not because they wanted to really serve the Lord, not because they respected the Lord, but because of their superstition. Well, if we help them build God's temple, then we're going to be blessed, as one of the gods blesses us. So the Assyrians, what did they do? They gave the Samaritans some Jews. The Jews taught the Samaritans how to worship God. The Samaritans incorporated their own pagan practices. And now, years later, what do we have? Now we have the Samaritans coming to the Jews, and Zerubbabel says, uh-uh. You know, they honored God. They respected God. They acknowledged God. But they still served the pagan gods of the surrounding areas. See, they didn't seek God as the Jews did. 1 Peter chapter 4 says something interesting in verses 3 through 5. He says, for we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. Amen? We spent enough time being pagans, haven't we? We spent enough time doing the will of the Gentiles. I think we spent more than enough time. And he says, when we walked in lewdness, lusts, drunkenness, revelries, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. And he describes the Samaritans in a nutshell. That's what they were doing. And that's what they were bringing back to Jerusalem. In regard to these, he says in verse 4, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation. And then they speak evil of you. They will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. You see, Peter warned us of the ways that the Gentiles worshipped their gods. And he warned us of the world. They had incorporated all of these sins into the worship of God and continued to worship their false gods at the same time. So if Zerubbabel would have allowed them to help, what would have been the outcome? What would have happened to the nation of Israel if they would have allowed the Samaritans to help? Well, they would have been corrupted, and they would have interfered with the work. You know, it's interesting. When we have this example from Exodus, remember when the Jews were leaving Egypt? What did God say? He says, just leave. But you know what they did? They took some friends from Egypt. And in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, we always think of this thing that it was just the Jews who left, right? It wasn't, because in Exodus 12 it says, a mixed multitude, keywords, mixed multitude, went up with them also in flocks and herds and a great deal of livestock, indicating Egyptians and other people went up with the Jews when they left Egypt. I can understand why. Would you want to hang out in Egypt? After all of the firstborn in the land were dead, the river was made into blood, the frogs and the flies and everything else were just so horrible, I wouldn't want to stay there either. They didn't go for a desire to serve God. They went out of fear of the plagues. And so now that you have this mixed multitude going on, and if you go all the way over to Numbers chapter 11, verse 4, you know what it says? About same exact phrase, mixed multitude, is there. It says, now the mixed multitude, meaning that there was a specific group of people who were not Jews, who were among them, meaning among the Jews, yielded to the intense craving, so that the children of Israel also went again and said, who will give us meat to eat? They were fine. That ever happen with your kids? Everybody's fine till somebody says, I'm hungry, and now everybody's hungry. You know what I'm talking about? It's like, why couldn't you just keep your mouth closed? We were fine. One person has to go to the bathroom. Everybody has to go to the bathroom. One person is irritated. It's like, just be quiet for 10 minutes. Keep that stuff to yourself. And that's what happened. They were led astray and they were caused to sin by the mixed multitude among them, because they weren't pure. Zerubbabel knew his history. He said, no, you can't help us. You know, keeping friends around you, helpers, or allowing those in the world to help you, allowing those that don't worship the Lord and in spirit and in truth, allowing those who will not honor him completely with their lives to help you, will only get you sidetracked. There's this age-old question, you know, what do we do with our old friends when we come to Christ? And a lot of people are torn, because especially today with Facebook and Twitter, and some of you, and I don't understand how you have time for this, you know every single person you graduated with, and you keep tabs on them, and you talk to them, and I don't know about you, but when I got done with high school, I ran and never looked back. I haven't talked to them or thought of them, or I don't get what some people do. They have to be just completely bound with these people for the rest of their lives. But, you know, it's not just our friendships. And it's important. We have to look at our friendships. You know, are you friends with the world? Are you friends with those in the world? Now, it's different to minister to the people in the world. And that's important that we do. Jesus, the friend of sinners and tax collectors, they called him, because he ministered to them. But who did he confide in and who did he trust? Not those people. He trusted his disciples. He trusted those whom he set on guard the night that he was in the garden praying. He left them at the gate while he went a little further in. He had people that he trusted, people that he allowed to do great and marvelous things with him and to help him in the ministry. But you don't see Jesus allowing the sinners and the tax collectors to hand out the bread and the fish to the 5,000 when he made it reproduce. You don't see Jesus sending them to catch the fish with the money in its mouth for the temple taxes. You don't see Jesus using them to heal people. You don't see Jesus using them for great and effective ministry. They were the ministry. And so many times in our lives, we allow friendship with the world to sidetrack us from the ministry, don't we? You know, Peter said it this way. All right, I'm sorry, James said it this way. Adulterers and adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. And that's something that's scary. You see, the enemy, he doesn't just come to you as an adversary that you can see. The enemy doesn't just come at you as somebody who seems evil and mean. If every thief, if every rapist, if every murderer look like this evil person who walked around in a black trench coat, would we allow what happened in Connecticut in our schools? No, we'd see him a mile away, wouldn't we? No, but it's those who act as our friends who can hurt us the most, isn't it? Those who we know who come bringing peace offerings. He will come to you in the light of friendship, offering you assistance in the Lord's work, but he only seeks whom he may kill, steal, and whom he may destroy. You know, one of the enemy's first and favorite tools to attack you and to oppose the work of the Lord is to detour you through cooperation. And I'd like you to write that on your first line of your outline if you're a note taker. He wants to detour you from the Lord's work by cooperating with you. Because once he binds himself to you, he can easily lead you astray. He can easily get you off track and keep you from fulfilling that which the Lord has for you. So many times today, we don't understand that we cannot bind ourselves to the world. You know, when we look at our financial problems, many times today I watch as you'll be watching TV or as you'll be listening to the radio, what do you hear? financial counselors out there, and they're ready to consumer credit crisis counselors or stuff like that. You've heard about this, right? Oh, and they'll tell you how to get rid of your financial issues and how you can get back on track. And people in the church today, they flock to these places desperately, desperately, desperately looking for help. And they bind themselves to these places. People who are suffering emotionally, they go to psychologists and psychotherapists, and they get drugs for their issues, and they bind themselves to the world through this declared intention of, oh, we want to help you. We want to help you through your emotional problems. So come talk to us. Pay us hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars so that we can get you sidetracked from the Lord's work. There are many people out there today who are dealing with issues with their children, and they don't know what to do, and so they take the help of the world and the advice of the world and Dr. Spock. No, not the one from Star Trek. Some of the younger kids have no idea who that is. It's okay. And what do? They want help with their problems, and so they're having a difficult time. I mean, imagine Israel. They're there all by themselves. It's taken 2 years just to lay the foundation of the temple. It's hard work. You have to reestablish communications, lines of supplies coming into the city, rebuild the homes while building the temple. Here comes some help. Awesome! We needed help. And maybe you felt like that with your finances, that you're just overwhelmed, or with your children, you're just overwhelmed, or with your emotions, you're just overwhelmed, or any other part of your life. And maybe it's with your marriage, and you say, I just need help. And somebody says, yeah, or we'll help you get a divorce. You'll feel a lot better later. And that's what the world does. They say that they want to help you. Just like the Samaritans came and said, we're going to help. But in the end, they only want to lead you astray. They want to derail you and detour you through their cooperation. And that's why Paul said, friendship with the world is enmity with the Lord. You know what's interesting is, as we look to our children and we're having issues with our children, or as we look and we look at our kids and we say, man, how do I do this? The Lord gave us an instruction manual. I know it doesn't seem like it sometimes, but he did. The more I read this, the more I realize I got my work cut out for me. You know, when we look at our emotional problems and we say, well, what do we do about this? Or how do we deal with that? He gave us a way to deal with those issues. Cast your cares upon me, he said. And when we look at our finances and we say, well, I don't know what to do with my finances. You know that the whole Bible contains 2,630 verses on finances. You know, Jesus talked more about your finances than he talked about heaven, hell, faith, or the Holy Spirit combined in the New Testament. Why? Because we're so bad at managing our finances that we obviously needed a lot of help. How many would you say amen? But we'll turn to the credit counselors or the credit cards, or we'll turn to these thieves on Wall Street who love to take our money, and we'll trust in them to help us. Oh, and we'll play the lottery because they want to help us. And we'll go to the world and we'll ask them for their help and we'll join ourselves to them. But what we don't realize is that they're just leading us off. They're detouring us from what the Lord has for us. All you have to do is read this and apply it. And you know what happens? You'll be successful. That's what he says. That's what he told Joshua. Joshua chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Have I not commanded you, be strong and very courageous? Only let this word of my law not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night. And then you will be prosperous, and all of your paths shall be made straight. Jesus said, who is my mother, my sister, and my brothers? Those who hear the word of God and do it. You see, it's not enough just to hear it. You have to do it. How do we keep ourselves from being diverted from the Lord's work? How do we keep ourselves from being detoured through the world's cooperation? Well, number one, you have to be in the Word every morning, every evening, every single day. Now, you may wake up late, and usually you'll probably shower if you wake up late, right? Just because you woke up late doesn't mean you're going to work stinky. And then you'll put your shoes on and you'll get dressed because you're not going naked. And then you'll get in your car and you'll turn it on and you'll drive to work. You'll hopefully brush your teeth. You might eat breakfast, grab a cup of coffee. Doesn't matter how late you are. There are certain things that you're unwilling to not do in the morning. Isn't that true? Would you go to work with your hair all messed up? Some of you have hair. And you will spend an hour to comb it. Even though you're late, you can't show up at work all with your hair in knots and sticking straight up like you put your fingers in a light socket. So what do? You spend time and you'll comb your hair and you'll get yourself ready, but you don't prepare yourself for the most important thing of the day. The Word of God. That you'll be able to do what's right and honorable. That you'll be able to be successful. Psalm 119:11 says, "Your word I have hidden in my heart, that I will not sin against you." How do we keep from being hoodwinked by the world and led astray through their cooperation? Well, number one, we're in the Word. Psalm 119:105 says, "Your word is a lamp unto my feet and a light unto my path." You see, as I know the Word, I have something to compare those people who say that they're my friends, who say they have a common interest, who say they have the common goal in mind. I have something now to compare them to. Zerubbabel had the Word of God to compare the Samaritans with. And when they didn't match up, he says, "You cannot help me." What do you compare your friends to? What are your requirements for fellowship? There have to be certain requirements in our lives. Now, that's not to say that I'm not going to minister to the lost. I will minister to the lost. And I will reach out to them. But at the same time, we wouldn't allow people from the world to come in and teach our kids in children's ministry, would we? Or come up here and stand at the pulpit and try to teach people how to have a better marriage just because they have some PhD in some pseudoscience. We wouldn't allow evolutionists to come and teach us what the Lord did in creation, would we? No. You see, there have to be conditions, or as we would, standards. Know those who you're friends with. Do they follow the Word? Are they true followers? Or are they those who, they say it with their mouths? I mean, there's people today, they acknowledge Jesus Christ, they believe in Jesus Christ, they believe He's the Son of God and that He died for their sins. But when it comes to service, actual service, they serve other gods. Jesus said you can't serve two masters, yet how many people today are trying to do just that? They pay lip service to Jesus, but when you look at their lives, you see they serve Asherah. They serve Baal. They serve Molech. They serve Mammon. Oh, they'll go to work and they'll serve money. All day, every day, they will serve money. But when it comes to the Lord's service, oh, they'll serve Him on Sunday. They'll only go to a service once a week. But the rest of the week, it's about money. It's about their career. It's about their ability to choose. Oh, yes, they'll serve Jesus until they get pregnant and they don't want the baby, and then it's, oh, well, I got to serve Molech for a few minutes, because that was how they served Molech. They would serve Molech by offering up their children under the fiery hands of a bronze statue that was red hot. And today our society says, oh, we're all Christians, but they serve Molech. Oh, we're all Christians, but they serve Mammon. Oh, we're all Christians, but they serve Asherah. See, Zerubbabel, he knew the Word, and he knew that the testimony of those friends wasn't right. And he said, no, thank you. We were commissioned. God called us to do it. We'll deal with it, thank you. Feel free to worship Him, but we're going to build the temple. He wasn't rude. He wasn't nasty. He didn't say, you bunch of pagan heathens! Nothing like that. He was very cordial, but he was very emphatic. He would do the work of the Lord with those who were called and empowered and led by the Lord. Who do you allow to assist you in the building of your home, your family, your friends? The world promises to help, but only to enslave you in wickedness before you even know it. So he says in verse 4, how did they respond? You can imagine they weren't feeling too happy when they were told no. I'm wondering if they were afraid that the lions were coming back. You don't understand, Zerubbabel. If we don't serve your God, the lions are coming back. You don't understand, Christians. If we don't serve your God, then the terrorists are going to come back. Would be an applicable way of saying it today. After 9/11, everybody went to church for about 3 weeks. Churches were full to the brim. They started building projects to extend the size of their buildings and everything because everybody was in church because there were lions in the streets, and we've got to serve God that the lions will be taken away. But until the lions come back, then they will become complacent because it's only lip service. And what we see here is that then the people of the land, meaning the Samaritans, what did they do? They tried to discourage the people of Judah. They troubled them in building, and they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all of the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. Now, this is interesting because here they say, you know what? You're not going to let us help you? If I can't do it, no one can. You ever heard that before? Ladies are the worst at this. You know, if I can't have him, no one can. You ever had that happen before? You ever seen that happen before? They tear each other apart over a boy who's not worth it. Don't worry, I have 4 daughters. I know what's coming to me. The more I read this book, the more I know I got my work cut out for me. Trust me. Oh, if we can't serve him, well, we're not going to let you. Now, if your fear was the lions, and you wanted the God to be served so that the lions wouldn't come back, what do you think is going to happen to you when you deny his true followers who were commissioned to build his temple not to do it? What's going to happen to you then? Remember what Peter said? Just a couple minutes ago we talked about it. We spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. In regards to these, he said in verse 4, they think it strange that you do not run with them in the same flood of dissipation, speaking evil of you, but they will give an account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. Ouch. They're going to have to stand before the Lord and say why they did what they did. But it's interesting because they tried to discourage them. And how did they do it? Through intimidation. And I'd like you to write that on that second line. They were going to intimidate the people. So what does Satan do? If you don't allow him to join your cause, if you don't let the devil on the board of directors of the church, if you don't let the devil into your home, if you don't let the devil into your finances, or if you don't let him into your relationships, if you do not allow him to commandeer your life through cooperation, then he moves on to his second favorite tool. And what is that? Intimidation. And if you didn't fall through the cooperation, you're bound to fall at intimidation. Peer pressure is like cooperation. At school, kids offering another kid a joint or drugs or alcohol or anything else, promiscuity. And what do they do? Everyone's doing it. It's going to make you feel better. You're going to love it. It's always through what? Cooperation. We're seeking your betterment. But if the student or the young person denies them their opportunity to cooperate, what do they say? Oh, you're just a loser. You're a goody two-shoes, is what they used to say. I don't think they say that anymore. I don't know what they say anymore. I don't really want to know, so don't let me know. But then they start to intimidate the others, don't they? When they can't force them through cooperation, they start to intimidate. And that's what the nations around them did. They hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all of the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia. Now, it's interesting. What did they do? Number one, it says they troubled them in building. How did they intimidate them? Well, that word trouble, it's like the word to torment. Remember when Sennacherib was coming against Israel and Hezekiah is there? He's coming against Jerusalem. Hezekiah is standing there. And he sends out the people, his emissaries, to talk with the troops of the Assyrians. And they said, what do you want? Well, talk in Aramaic, not in Hebrew. We don't want them to know what you're saying. And so the people that were there, the armies of the Assyrians, started screaming out in Hebrew in their own words, intimidating them, taunting them, discouraging them. We're going to kill you and you're all going to die. And if you guys don't stop this right now and give up and give in, then we're just going to surround you and you're all going to die. You're going to starve to death. No other nation has ever stood up to us and won. You guys are going to lose. Intimidation. And so when it says they troubled them in building, they're taunting them. You know, discouragement and fear are effective weapons, especially when the work is already difficult, isn't it? Things are hard enough as it is. You ever have that happen? One time I was pushing a car up a hill by myself. And I remember I'm holding on to the back bumper and I'm pushing as hard as I can. And I'm pushing and somebody walks up to me and it was like out of a movie. This person's holding an apple in their hand. They're eating an apple watching me push the car up the hill. You're never going to make it, you know. That's a long ways. Where are you going? All the way up there, huh? I don't think you're ever going to make it. That's a long ways. And then, by the time you do get it to the top of the hill, you don't have a rock to put behind the back tire, so it's going to roll all the way back down while you're trying to jump into the driver's seat and hit the parking brake. And they sat there taunting me. It's like, this is already hard enough. I don't need your help. Go away. You know what? That's what happens in the world, isn't it? You already have a hard enough time in your marriage, and it's already frustrating enough, and then you've got someone from the world taunting you. You know what? Just get a divorce already. It's not going to work out. This is too hard. You're such a loser. You know what? You're never going to make it. You're only on the first day of your marriage. You're on the first year. This is only the first month. You know, just give up. It's not going to happen. Trust me. Our way's easier. We tried to tell you before. We tried to tell you to let us help you, but no. You want to do it the hard way? Well, look at what's going to happen to you. This is what's going to happen to you, and you're never going to make it. You know, your kids, you might as well just give up on them right now because you know what? They're losers. That's what the world wants you to believe. You'll never make it. You'll never be able to change them. Look at that. We've already got a hold of them. Might as well just turn them over now. You know, your finances are so lost. Your God can't help you with your finances. Look at what you've done. You're $50,000 in debt. You think your God's going to be able to get you out of this? Look at you. You're never going to make it. You guys are so lost. That's what the enemy wants you to hear. It's hard enough to live right and honorably and do the work of the Lord that you called to do. It's hard enough to want to get out of bed on Sunday morning for a pastor, okay? Much less one of the sheep. And then the enemy, he's there. You know, you're never going to make it on time. You're already late. Why even go to church? You're only going to make it for the last 15 minutes of service. You know, everybody's going to laugh at you when you get there. Uh-huh, look at him. He's always late. She's never on time. And her kids come into service screaming, oh, they're going to laugh at you. Might as well just stay home and watch TV. Save yourself the embarrassment. Isn't that what the enemy wants us to feel? Isn't that what he wants to convince us of as we're trying? It's already hard enough, and he's sitting there eating his apple, intimidating us, telling us how hard it is. I'm doing the work. I know how hard it is. Leave me alone. You know, they'll speak evil of you and they'll attack you. But Isaiah chapter 12, verse 2 says, behold, my God is my salvation. I will trust and I will not be afraid. For Yah, the Lord, is my strength and my song, and he has also become my salvation. When the going gets tough, trust in the Lord. Grab on with both hands and don't let him go. And don't let the world tell you that you're never going to make it or that it's impossible. Or that it's too hard, but you trust in him and you say, I will stay the course. I will finish the race. I will press on. So what do they do? Well, they're taunting them. Israel, they keep plotting. They keep trying. They're going out to pull these huge stones out of a quarry, and what do they have to do? They're taking these huge stones up a mountain. And there's the Samaritans digging trenches in the road and making it hard and blockading the quarry routes and stealing the supply trains that are coming into Jerusalem, doing whatever they can to just torment them. And then, when that doesn't work, what do they do? They start bribing officials, and they hired counselors. Literally, they put on the payroll the king's counselors, is what it is. They started bribing the officials back in the capital. So that when the Jews requested more money or more supplies, haven't we already given you enough? Haven't we already done this? Haven't we already done that? getting faulty or getting them not to give them what they were supposed to get. They would hire and bribe the king's counselors to stir up trouble, fabricate lies about the Jews. They would hinder their finances, hinder their supplies, even authorization to work on the temple. They would bribe everyone around them. So when they couldn't discourage them directly, they would go a different route. They get other people to help them and incite everyone else. No one's going to help you now. And then it's interesting that the enemy doesn't just give up. He persists and he keeps going and he keeps going and he keeps going, especially when you give him some room. You know, the enemy is persistent. He will continue to intimidate you until you can't go any further. They were hindered for 16 years. Did you know that? 16 years. In building the temple, they stopped for 16 years. Why? Because they gave in to intimidation. James said, therefore, submit to God. In James chapter 4, verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. You know what happens when the devil has tried and tried and tried and he can't get anywhere with you? He moves on to somebody else who's an easier target. He gives up. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. You know, that's a wonderful promise that we have from the Lord. That means that this too shall pass. One of the most awesome verses in the entire Bible. This too shall pass. Resist the devil. You stand up. You stand fast, and you do what you are called to do. It's going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. There's going to be obstacles, but if you stay the course, if you get to where God has called you to go, if you do what God has called you to do, then you will be rewarded in due time. That's what James chapter 1, verse 12 says. Those who persevere, they will be given the crown of glory. From this point on, the rest of the chapter really is, there's a lot of people who dispute how the rest of the chapter goes. See, we've been talking about the temple and the rebuilding of the temple, but in verse 6 on, he changes and he starts talking about the city walls. Now, they weren't trying to rebuild the city walls right now. What were they trying to rebuild? The temple. So there's two ways to look at this, and I've given you guys a handout this morning. You can go over at home. It has the names of all of the kings of the Persians, as well as the dates that they reigned. And it talks about this controversy. You see, verses 6 through 23, take a look, since Ezra's already talking about this opposition that the Jews are facing. He takes a step forward in time, and he talks to us about what? The way that they also hindered the walls of Jerusalem, because that didn't happen until way later. And so this kind of talks about that. I encourage you to look at that later. But I'd like to end in verses 6 through 24 by talking about the final blow of the enemy. And how did he get them? How did he finalize their inability to work on the temple? And this is one of the things that we see in our current culture, in our nation right now. And yet we see Christians rolling over because they don't do anything about it. And that is that they denounce their works through legislation. I'd like you to write that on that third line. Legislation, laws. What happens in verse 6? The reign of Ahasuerus. In the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Who wrote it? Well, the counselors that they were paying to write it. In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam, Mithridath, and Tabal, and the rest of their companions wrote to Artaxerxes, king of Persia, and the letter was written in Aramaic script and translated into the Aramaic language. Rehum the commander and Shimshai the scribe wrote a letter against Jerusalem to King Artaxerxes in this fashion. From Rehum the commander, Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of the companions, representatives of the Dinanites and Epaphrasites, the Tarpites, and if you have a better pronunciation, God bless you. The people of Persia and Erech and Babylon and Shushan and the Dehavites and the Elamites and all of the other ites that were there, and the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Osnapper, sounds like a fish, took captive and settled in the city of Samaria, and the remainder beyond the river, and so forth. I love that, and so forth. And yada, yada, yada. And this is a copy of the letter that they sent to him. To King Artaxerxes, from your servants, the men of the region behind the river, and so forth. You know, we're lazy. We don't want to write it all out. So everybody else. Let it be known to the king that the Jews who came up from you have come to us at Jerusalem. They came to us as if they own the place and are building the rebellious and evil city. And they're finishing its walls and repairing the foundations. Now, notice it's talking about the city's walls. Now, were they working on the city's walls in the time of Ezra? Not until Nehemiah got there. And that's who was in charge of rebuilding the walls. So we see that this is a look into what? The future, at something that happens. But he wants to include it here so we understand all of the opposition that Israel was going through. Let it now be known, verse 13, to the king that if this city is built and the walls are completed, they will not pay you their money. They will not pay tax, tribute, or custom, and the king's treasury will be diminished. They're going to rob you blind and make you poor. Now, because we receive support from the palace, because you pay us and you help us, we want to really make sure that you're okay. It was not proper for us to see the king's dishonor. Therefore, we have sent and informed the king that such may be made in the book of the records of your fathers. So write it down in the law books. Make it down in the history books that these Jews are evil and that they need to be stopped. And isn't that what's happening in the church today? Write it down in the books that it's these Christians that are hurting the country and that they need to be stopped. It's the Christians who want to help people not be homosexual anymore and counsel them in God's word so that they would stop homosexuality and choose to live righteously before the Lord. They're evil. They're discriminating and they need to be stopped. So they legislate against it, don't they? You know, there's a law now that pastors, supposedly it's being challenged in court, but pastors can go to prison if they try to help a young person who wants to not be homosexual. They counsel them against homosexuality. You know, a pastor can go to prison in the state of California today? In our nation, they have legislated for gay, lesbian, and transgender and all that other stuff. They have legislated to allow women to kill their unborn children. They have legislated and taken away the authority of the church as much as they possibly can with the IRS and others. They have legislated against Christianity, and they continue to do so, even with the healthcare law and how they are forcing Christians to pay for birth control and planned parenting and abortions for everyone else. They are legislating against Christians, just like we see here. Write it in your book. And we want you to look in the history books, he says in verse 15, that the search may be made in the book of the records of your fathers, and you will find in the book of the records and know that this city is a rebellious city. They don't follow the path of the world. They stand up to the world, and they only follow their own God. Oops. That's what their accusation was. They're a righteous city. They're harmful to kings and provinces. They're harmful to kings and provinces. Well, yeah, they took out 185,000 of the Assyrians in one night. But they didn't do it themselves. They did it through what? The Lord. The Lord did it. And their Lord is dangerous. And they have incited sedition within the city in former times, for which cause the city was destroyed. That's why it was killed in the first place. And we don't want to let them rise again. So they say in verse 16, we inform the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls are completed, the result will be that you will have no dominion beyond the river. They're going to take away your authority and power. So the king responded in verse 17, to Rehum the commander and all these other people, to the rest of their companions who dwell in Samaria, to the remainder beyond the river, peace and so forth. All that other stuff. The letter which you have sent us has been clearly read before me, and I gave the command, and a search has been made, and it was found that this city in former times has revolted against kings, and a rebellion and sedition have been fostered in it. There have also been mighty kings over Jerusalem who have ruled over all of the region beyond the river, and tax, tribute, and custom were paid to them. Now I give the command to make these men cease, that this city may not be built until the command is given by me. Take heed now that you do not fail to do this. Why should damage increase to the hurt of the kings? Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum, Shimshai, the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem against the Jews, and by force of arms made them cease. Thus the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, ceased, and it was discontinued until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. They gave an official accusation against the Jews, and they said they're evil and they're wrong, and we got to stop them. And that's what's being said about the church today in our country. They want to take away our freedom to kill our babies, our freedom to be sexually immoral, our freedom to live however we want. They want to take away our freedom to smoke marijuana and to drink alcohol. And they want to take away our freedom to smoke cigarettes and do drugs. And they want to take away our freedom to not worship God. And they want to force God on our money, and they want to force God in our courts, and they want to force God in our military, and we got to get rid of them. We got to get rid of these Christians. That's what's going on today in our legislation. That's what's going on today in our government. And sadly, how many Christians turned out at the polls? Not enough. And what are we watching? We're watching our ability to serve the Lord being legally eroded before our very eyes. And yet so many times people sit silent in their seats and they do nothing. All it would have taken was 30 minutes at the polls, one Tuesday night every 4 years. That's too much, Pastor. I got things to do. Barney Fife is still on TV. And we let it go. 16 years of waiting. 16 years. Now, you know what's interesting? We don't have time to read Haggai chapter 1. But I want you to go home and read Haggai chapter 1. We might say, well, it's not their fault. They were forced to not do it. Now, wait a minute. God had told them, go rebuild the temple. At first, he said, go to captivity, didn't he? Go be captive. And then, what did he say? Now go back and build my temple. What did they do? Ezra and Nehemiah doesn't tell us the whole story. Haggai chapter 1 gives us the rest of the picture. Let me just give you a kind of overview. Haggai tells us that God in Haggai rebukes the people of Israel for not building his house. Haggai chapter 1 verse 3. They, in verse 4, had put off construction of the temple to build their own paneled houses. They had taken 16 years to build up their own homes and businesses. All because there was some opposition legally. They just laid down and died. They just stopped. And they built their own houses. As a result, God chastised them with economic hardships. We see that in Haggai 1:6. And he sent a drought in Haggai 1:11. You know what happened when he did that? These difficulties further hindered their work on the temple. Because now they're spending more and more time on their own personal needs rather than the ministry that God had called them to, because it was too hard. Now, it's not specifically stated, but we can imagine how the people of Judah, faced with the threats of harassments from outsiders and turned away from God's work to meet their own personal needs, and what are they doing? They're just focusing on themselves for 16 years, focusing on what they wanted. And as the years passed, it became easier and easier and easier to procrastinate at resuming the work on the temple. It became easier not to read the word. It became easier not to pray. It became easier not to worship the Lord. Isn't that the way it works when you backslide? Extreme opposition or a difficult trial causes us to stop serving the Lord. And then what happens? Very quickly, it just becomes easier and easier and easier to just not serve the Lord, because of those who are around you or opposing you. By the time that Darius got into power, the only one that could motivate the people to rebuild the temple was God himself. And that's what we're going to look at next week in Ezra chapter 5. God told him, that's enough. You guys get up and you do what I've asked you to do. Israel, because they didn't follow the commandment of God, their lives suffered. Their finances suffered. Their families suffered. Their kids weren't focused on the Lord. They were doing pagan things, and they wondered, why is this happening to us? Nehemiah spent half of his time, Ezra spent half of his time telling the people, get right with God. Because the parents weren't diligent to do what was right before the Lord. The kids weren't diligent. And what do you think happened to the grandkids? we today, we're not diligent to serve the Lord, then what will happen? If you don't serve God with all of your heart, if you don't teach your kids by example, then your kids aren't going to do it. And how great will their destruction be? Folks, it's time that as a body, we determine in our hearts, we will serve the Lord no matter what. No matter what they've legislated, no matter how they intimidate us, no matter how they say that they want to be our friends but really aren't, we will serve the Lord and Him only. And when it's hard, we will serve Him and Him only. And when it's hurtful and difficult and people are against us, we will serve Him and Him only. Don't lose focus of your calling, your call to ministry, your call to service in the light of the enemy's favorite devices of cooperation, intimidation, legislation. Don't allow your walk to get sidetracked. For years, 16 years they were there. If you're backslidden, return to the Lord. You know what the Lord's saying? It's time. It's time that you got up and you did what was right. It's time that you did the hard things. It's time that you honor me. Seek first my kingdom. Seek first what I have given you to do. I'll take care of the rest. But it's time. Time to face the opposition.